Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Jeremiah chapter 51, which I will entitle The Utter Destruction of Babylon, Part A. Now, in previous audios, Jeremiah 51 through 28, I call that section Judgment on Babylon, Part A, and then Jeremiah 50, verses 29 through 46, I call that Judgment on Babylon, Part B. Now, in Jeremiah 51, verses 1 through 32, in this audio, I call this The Utter Destruction of Babylon, Part A. So you see what we're doing here. We're just talking about more doom and gloom on Babylon, that nasty foreign nation that took the Israelites, the Judahites, into captivity in 586 B.C. And now they're going to get judged for doing that, even though God meant for them to do that in order to chastise the idolatrous Jews. Now let me give you a little bit of introduction to this chapter. This prophecy was given to Sarah to be cast into the Euphrates as a token of the perpetual shaking of Babylon. We read that at the end of the chapter, which we'll go over in our next audio. Jeremiah 51, verses 59 through 64 says this. This is what Jeremiah the prophet commanded Sarah, son of Neriah, son of Maaseiah, the quartermaster, when he went to Babylon with King Zedekiah. Zedekiah ruled from 597 to 586, at which time he was blinded by the Babylonians and taken into captivity. And along with him was this gentleman, Sarah. Jeremiah gave Sarah a prophecy, wrote it down, and Sarah took it into Babylon to read to the captives there. Verse 60, Jeremiah 51. Jeremiah wrote on one scroll about all the disaster that would come to Babylon. All these words were written against Babylon. Jeremiah told Sarah, when you get to Babylon, see that you read all these words aloud. You must say, Lord, you have threatened to cut off this place so that no one will live in it, man or beast. Indeed, it will remain desolate forever. Now think about that. That's a gutsy prophecy because Babylon had just ground Judah into the ground and had burnt the capital city, Jerusalem, into ashes. Babylon was one of the most feared nation of the ancient Near East. They were the big dogs in the area, and Jeremiah says, they're going to be desolate forever. I want you to read that to the captives. In verse 64, Jeremiah then continues talking to Sarah. In the same way, Babylon will sink and never rise again because of the disaster I am bringing on her. They will grow weary. Well, that's some words of encouragement. The words of Jeremiah end here at the end of the chapter. So let's begin now, and since I'm going to cover 32 verses in this audio, I'm not going to read sections of scripture at a time. I'm going to take it verse by verse just to save a little bit of time. Verse 1, this is what the Lord says, see, I will stir up the spirit of a destroyer against Babylon. The destroyer is Persia, as Colin Dillich says. Benson makes the point that the destroyer is not only Cyrus the Great of Persia, who ruled from 559 to 530. He conquered Babylonia in 539. But he didn't really destroy the place. Darius I destroyed Babylon somewhere around 520 or so. Darius the Great of Persia ruled from 522 to 486. Benson mentions both Cyrus and Darius, and I think you need to do that to take care of that objection to Jeremiah's prophecy that Cyrus didn't really cause desolation of Babylon. He just basically conquered the place and took it over without doing a lot of damage. But when Babylon rebelled as a rebellious province about 520, Darius did come in. It's a great story Herodotus tells us. I'm not going to spend time with it. I mentioned it in a previous audio, last two or three audios. But that's the destroyer that's coming against Babylon. And that destroyer, Persia, is going to come against the people of Leb Kamei. What in the world is that? Well, the NIV note, marginal note, says that Leb Kamei is a cryptogram for Babylon, a word written in code. Barnes says the cipher for Kazdim, i.e. Chaldea. That's what Leb Kamei is, a cipher. This cipher was not necessarily invented by Jeremiah or used for concealment. It was probably first devised, either for political purposes or for trade, and was in time largely employed in the correspondence between the exiles at Babylon and their friends at home. Thus, words in common use like Shishak, Jeremiah 25:26, and Leb Kamei would be known to everybody. This is Albert Barnes that says that. Now let's look at some other translations of this phrase, Leb Kamei. God's Word Translation and the New American Standard Bible translates the same as the NIV. Basically transliterates the Hebrew, Leb Kamei. Other translations do it this way. Here's the Holman Christian Study Bible marginal note. Literally, heart of my adversaries. And so the verse would read, "See, I will stir up the spirit of a destroyer against Babylon and against the heart of my adversaries." In other words, heart of my adversaries would be in opposition with Babylon. And the destroyer, Persia, would come against Babylon, who is a people in the heart, in the middle of those who are my adversaries. The Bible in Basic English translates it this way. The Lord has said, "See, I will make a wind of destruction come up against Babylon and against those who are living in Chaldea." Instead of against those of Leb Kamei, against those who are living in Chaldea, they just translate the cipher for us and tell us what it means. Chaldea, which is Babylon, of course. Jeremiah 51:1. This is the Darby translation. "Thus saith Jehovah, behold, I will raise up against Babylon and against them that dwell in the heart of those that rise against me." In other words, the core of my opposition, all those adversaries who are in the middle of all my enemies, they're going to be having to fight the Persians who are coming. The Babylonians are the core of my adversaries. They're in the heart of my adversaries, and I'm going to raise up a destroyer against them, namely Persia. Verse 2, "I will send foreigners to Babylon to winnow her." Winnowing is the process of taking wheat in a pitchfork, throwing the wheat up into the air and letting the wind blow the chaff away from the grain. It's a separation. Basically, Babylon's going to be thrown up in the air and ripped apart is the import of that metaphor. So foreigners, continuing in verse 2, will oppose Babylon on every side in the day of her disaster. "Let not the archer string his bow, nor let him put on his armor. Do not spare her young men. Completely destroy her army." In other words, Babylonians, don't fight. You're cooked. "For they," the young men, the army, "will fall down slain in Babylon, fatally wounded in her streets. For Israel and Judah have not been forsaken by their God, the Lord Almighty, though their land is full of guilt before the Holy One of Israel." God's not going to let them forget that they're guilty. Just because they're going to be delivered, they're still full of guilt. That's why they're in exile. Notice in verse 5, Jeremiah mentions Israel and Judah together. He does this constantly. Israel has already been carried off into captivity in 722 B.C., but even they, the northern 10 tribes, are going to come back. And when Judah, the southern 2 tribes, come back, they're going to reestablish Israel, and the northern 10 tribes will be a part of that, probably represented by exiles streaming in from various areas of the ancient Near East where they had been carried into exile by Assyria in 722. Israel and Judah have not been forsaken, even though their land is full of guilt. Verse 6, Yahweh now speaks rhetorically to the people of Babylon. "Flee from Babylon. Run for your lives. Do not be destroyed because of her sins. It is time for the Lord's vengeance. He will pay her what she deserves." Babylon was a gold cup in the Lord's hand. Remember, Babylon was God's instrument in order to chastise the people of Judah. The Lord's hand. God sovereignly used that evil nation. God can use anybody, including evil actors, to accomplish his purposes. And so Babylon, the gold cup, it had wine in it. The nation's drinking for wine. That wine is wine that makes the nation stagger, makes them crazy. Therefore, they have now gone mad. That's what happens when you participate in an evil empire like Babylon. I don't have the verse with me, but it just occurred to me this sounds so much like the whore of Babylon in Revelation. She had that gold cup up there and full of wine, and the nations were drinking of it. That's where the imagery comes from, right here in Jeremiah. Maybe other places too. We go now to Jeremiah 51, starting in verse 8. "Babylon will suddenly fall and be broken." If you recall the story, which we will talk about when we get to Daniel, Belshazzar's feast, 539, when Cyrus the Great's army whacked Belshazzar, the ruling regent of Babylon at the time. He was having a feast. He was having a good time. And all of a sudden, how did the Persians get past the gates? They came up the dry Euphrates riverbed because they had dammed up the Euphrates River, came right up the river which ran in the middle of the city of Babylon, and the writing was on the wall for Belshazzar and Babylon. It happened all of a sudden. They didn't think they were going to go down to the Persians. Verse 8, "Babylon will suddenly fall and be broken. Wail over her." Again, God is talking rhetorically to the Babylonians. "Get balm for her pain. Perhaps she can be healed." That perhaps is sarcastic. Obviously, Babylon would not be healed. Verse 9, now there's a quotation within a quotation. Yahweh is speaking, but now Yahweh is quoting perhaps friends and allies of Babylon, or maybe prophets and good people in Babylon. I think he's probably talking to the friends and allies of Babylon, who say this, "We would have healed Babylon, but she cannot be healed. Let us leave her and each go to his own land, for her judgment reaches to the skies. It rises as high as the clouds." Think of fire reaching up to the sky, reaching up to the clouds as the city burns. Obviously, the city didn't burn under Cyrus, but it did under Darius, circa 520 B.C. Verse 10, now Yahweh is quoting the Jews. I assume it's the Jews who are captive in Babylon. "The Lord has vindicated us." Well, now, vindicated. Israel was so evil. Jeremiah had preached all kinds of gloom and doom on Judah. But still, Judah named the name of Yahweh as their God, so they were relatively good compared to Babylon. So in that way, Judah was vindicated by being set free from Babylon by the Persians. "The Lord has vindicated us," the Jews say. "Come, let us tell in Zion," in other words, after they get back to Jerusalem. Zion is the city in Jerusalem, a metonymy that stands for the whole city, the mountain, which is the part standing for the whole of Jerusalem. "But let us tell in Zion what the Lord our God has done." Now God, in verse 11, turns his rhetoric back to the Babylonians. "Sharpen the arrows, take up the shields. The Lord has stirred up the kings of the Medes." The Medes, of course, are the Persians, because it was the Medo-Persian Empire, Media being the big nation in the northern Iranian plateau that Cyrus had taken over and merged it with his kingdom, and so it was called the Medo-Persian Empire. So this is the Persians God is talking about. "God has stirred up the kings of the Medes." That would be Cyrus and Darius, I believe, because his purpose, God's purpose, is to destroy Babylon. "The Lord will take vengeance for his temple." In other words, "You Babylonians burnt down my temple." That was not just the Israelites' temple, the people of Judah's temple. That was my temple, and you Babylonians burn it down, and you're going to pay. Now, I said verse 11 was God speaking to the Babylonians. Actually, he's talking to the Persians to sharpen arrows, take up the shields against Babylon. In verse 12, the Persians are to lift up a banner against the walls of Babylon. That would be a banner of victory. "Reinforce the guard, station the watchmen, prepare an ambush." In other words, Persian army, get ready to do your duty. "The Lord will carry out his purpose, his decree against the people of Babylon." Verse 13, "You who live by many waters are rich in treasures." Now, that's Babylon. That's a common name for Babylon. "You who live by many waters." Why the title? Well, here's what John Gill says. "The great river Euphrates, which being branched out into several canals or rivers, both ran through it, through Babylon, and encompassed it. Hence, mention is made of the rivers of Babylon in Psalms 137, and a fit emblem this city was of mystical Babylon, which is also said to sit on many waters, interpreted of people and nations in Revelation 17. Now let me read those scriptures to you. Psalms 137:1, "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion." This is talking about the exiles on the way out of Judah. They sat down by the rivers of Babylon. Lots of rivers, lots of canals. The Euphrates and canals running into the Euphrates, running through the city. Revelation 17:1, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me. Come, I will show you the judgment of the notorious prostitute who sits on many waters." That's the whore of Babylon, which in my humble Orthodox Protestant opinion refers to the apostate nation of Israel, which murdered Jesus and persecuted the prophets. "I will show you the judgment of the notorious prostitute, the whore of Babylon, who sits on many waters." She sits on many waters. That's a reference to Babylon. Revelation 17:15, "He also said to me, the waters you saw where the prostitute was seated." So in the vision, John saw a prostitute sitting. She was actually on a beast, but she and the beast were on waters. Those waters stood for peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. So in verse 13, Jeremiah 51, Yahweh says, "You, Babylon, you live by many waters, you're rich in treasures. Your end has come, the time for you to be cut off, i.e. destroyed." Verse 14, "The Lord Almighty has sworn by himself," because he can't swear by anything higher, so he has to swear by himself, "I will surely fill you with men as with a swarm of locusts, and they will shout in triumph over you." And that would refer to the Persian armies under Cyrus the Great in 539 B.C., at least. Perhaps even to Darius coming in and doing the same thing. Around 520. We go now to Revelation 51, verses 15 through 19, starting in verse 15. He made the earth by his power. This is Jeremiah talking about Yahweh now. He made the earth by his power. He founded the world by his wisdom and stretched out the heavens by his understanding. When he thunders, the waters in the heavens roar. He makes clouds rise from the ends of the earth. If you look out towards the horizon and you see clouds in the sky, it looks like the clouds are coming right out of the earth into the sky. God sends lightning with the rain and brings out the wind from his storehouses. Every man is senseless and without knowledge. Every goldsmith is shamed by his idols. His images are a fraud. They have no breath in them. They are worthless, the object of mockery. When their judgment comes, they will perish. Verse 19, he who is the portion of Jacob is not like these, for he is the maker of all things. He's not made, he's the maker. An idol is made, God makes. He is the maker of all things, including the tribe of his inheritance, that would be Israel. The Lord Almighty is his name. And I need to remind us that Jeremiah uses Israel and Judah usually indiscriminately, Judah being representative of the whole nation of Israel, and also representing the 10 northern tribes who were sometimes called Israel. And Judah is sometimes called Judah as separate from Israel to point out the southern two tribes of the nation. The two terms basically mean the same. So the tribe of his inheritance would be Israel. Notice that he who is the portion of Jacob, God is the inheritance. That's what portion means, a double portion, double inheritance. God is the portion of Jacob. Jacob stands for Israel. So Israel gets to inherit Yahweh. That's pretty good inheritance. You can't go wrong with an inheritance like that. The only difference is that Israel gets to inherit, but the testator does not die because God never dies. We go down to Jeremiah 51, verses 20 through 23. Verse 20, you are my war club, my weapon for battle. With you I shatter nations. With you I destroy kingdoms. With you I shatter horse and rider. With you I shatter chariot and driver. With you I shatter man and woman. With you I shatter old man and youth. With you I shatter young man and maiden. With you I shatter shepherd and flock. With you I shatter farmer and oxen. With you I shatter governors and officials. Well, I guess Jeremiah gets his idea across. This war club shatters everything in sight. Now, the interesting thing is there are three options as to what this war club is, and the commentators split all over the place. First option, it's the Persians who are God's war club being used to clobber Babylon. Ellicott says that's the most probable option. Benson likes that option too. Cambridge commentary says that verse 24, the very next verse in Jeremiah 51, supports that option because that verse says, I will repay Babylon and all the residents of Chaldea for all their evil they have done in Zion. In other words, God is going to repay Babylon by using Persia as a war club. Now, that makes a lot of sense. That's the way I took it when I first read it. However, many commentators say the war club is the Babylonians being used against the Israelites. The Cambridge commentator says this is perhaps the most preferable option. Here are what two commentators say. Albert Barnes says, quote, most commentators consider that Babylon was the mace of God or the war club of God. Poole says, quote, interpreters are here divided, whether by Cyrus, whom God made use of to destroy Babylon and many other places, or Babylon. I rather incline to interpret it of Babylon, as indeed the most do, and so it should be. So I guess the Persian option is a minority opinion. Here's some arguments in favor of Babylon being the war club of Yahweh. Context, the pulpit commentary points out that Babylon is the last nation addressed back up in verse 14. Actually, going back to the end of verse 12, his decree is against the people of Babylon. Verse 14, I will surely fill you with men with a swarm of locusts. So he's talking about Babylon, and so it makes sense to say that, according to this view, that Babylon is being referred to in verse 20. The problem with that is that Babylon is just being mentioned in the context of being smashed, not smashing. So that argument doesn't sway me. Another argument is that in the last chapter, in verse 23, a similar title was given to Babylon. Jeremiah 50, verse 23, how the hammer of the whole earth is cut down and smashed. What a horror Babylon has become among the nations. The hammer of the whole earth. Okay, but that was last chapter. I'm going to take it to be Persia. There's a third option, is Israel. This is the pulpit commentator's favorite option. Israel is a hammer, a war club. that smashes. Here are two scriptures that back up that idea. Isaiah 41 verse 15. See, I will make you, Israel, into a sharp threshing board, new with many teeth. You will thresh mountains and pulverize them and make hills into chaff. Psalm 149 verses 7 through 9. Inflicting vengeance on the nations and punishment on the peoples, binding their kings with chains and their dignitaries with iron shackles, carrying out the judgment decreed against them. This honor is for all his godly people. Hallelujah. I'm going to go with the Persians. They're going to shatter the Babylonians. That fits in the context with the chapter to me, in my humble opinion. We go now to Jeremiah 51, verses 24 through 26. Verse 24. Before your eyes, Yahweh says, I will repay Babylon and all who live in Babylonia for all the wrong they have done in Zion, declares the Lord. And I'm assuming the eyes he's talking about are the eyes of the Babylonians who watch this before your eyes. I am against you, O destroying mountain. Well, now, why is Babylon called a mountain? Babylon is situated in a plain. Well, because of Babylon's high walls, its lofty towers, its hanging gardens. You look at the city from a distance and it makes it look like the city is a high mountain. I am against you, verse 25, O destroying mountain, you who destroy the whole earth, declares the Lord. I will stretch out my hand against you, roll you off the cliffs, and make you a burned out mountain. So he's using mountain metaphorically there. He's going to roll them off the cliffs. Verse 26, no rock will be taken from you for a cornerstone, nor any stone for a foundation. Why not? Because you will be desolate forever. There are no more rocks in you to be carried out. There are no more building materials from ruined buildings. You are so wrecked, people can't even use your ruins, which is often done, by the way, in the ancient world. The tourist site of Ephesus, I recall, had a lot of stones missing because people used those stones for building materials. But not Babylon, for you will be desolate forever. Now, verse 26, when God says that Babylon will be desolate forever, we need to remember that that word translated forever is the Hebrew olam. And olam, when you look it up in the dictionary, it can merely mean for a long time rather than perpetually and eternally. So Babylon is going to be desolate for a long time. Now, in a previous audio, either the last one or the one before that, I talked about the history of the desolation of Babylon, how Babylon gradually sank into nothingness. And I'm not going to go back over all that. I'm just going to describe a picture of the present-day Babylon I'm looking at now. It ain't nothing but rocks, ruins. Now, Saddam Hussein tried to put up what some source said was a tacky renovation of Babylon. He's not exactly an archaeologist. But if you look at the picture, it's pretty desolate. And it's been that way for a long, long time. So maybe we can take Olam there to mean forever and ever and ever, world without end, eternally. Of course, we don't know. Somebody might go in there and want to build it up again. It's nothing but a bunch of marsh. But we don't want to hang too much theology on that word forever, because it can mean just like a long, long time. But that doesn't take away from the awesomeness of this prophecy. Remember, when Jeremiah is prophesying, Babylon was a big dog in the ancient Near East. They were the nation that just carried off Judah into exile. And Jeremiah's got the cheek to say, you're going down and you're going to be desolate forever. He also said that in Jeremiah 50, verse 39. Therefore, desert creatures will live with hyenas, and ostriches will also live in her. It will never again be inhabited or lived in through all generations. Now, some people say that prophecy wasn't fulfilled because Babylon was inhabited. Well, it was, but less and less and less until it turned into nothing. I went through the history of Babylon. How Nicator I, the Seleucid emperor, built Seleucia to the north a little bit. Within about, 50 or 60 miles on the Tigris River. And then after that, the Parthians built Ctesiphon, another city, and they carried all the wealth out of Babylon and built those other two cities. And those other two cities became prominent, and Babylon just gradually sank into nothingness. And that's where it is today. We go now to Jeremiah 51, verse 27. God shifts his address from the Babylonians to the Persians. Lift up a banner in the land. That would be the land of Medo-Persia, where Cyrus is getting his troops together. Blow the trumpet among the nations. Prepare the nations for battle against her, against Babylon. Summon against her these kingdoms. Now, kingdoms, let me just summarize what I'm about to tell you. Kingdoms, Armenia. This is from Gil Clark and Jameson Fawcett Brown. They all say Armenia. I'm going to go through the geography in just a minute. But let me tell you where Armenia is. If you look at the Tigris River, which is the western boundary of present-day Iran, the old ancient nation of Persia, and then if you go up the Tigris till you get to Nineveh, or right to the east of Nineveh, is the northern part of Iran, which is Media. Well, if you keep going, you're in Media, and you keep following the Tigris River as it bends toward the east, starting at Nineveh. And if you go straight north from Nineveh, 200-400 miles, that's Armenia. It's the land between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, a little bit south of those two seas, and in between those two seas. It's the land that encompasses Lake Van and Lake Urmia. Those two lakes are below the Araxes River, which runs from the high mountains of Ararat all the way down into the Caspian Sea. Why would these kingdoms be summoned to battle? Because they belong to Persia. They're northern kingdoms north of Persia. They'll be in the army that comes down to the south to whip up on Babylon. Now, let's look at these three kingdoms. The first is Ararat. I'm looking at a map. You look at Nineveh. You go north of Nineveh. Nineveh is on the Tigris River, so if you go north of the Tigris River, northeast of the Tigris River, and go all the way up to the Araxes River, and then go all the way up to the Cyrus River, the Black Sea will be a little bit to the north and to the west, and the Caspian Sea will be to the east. Lake Van and Lake Urmia are right there in that region. That's the ancient nation of Ararat. That's pretty much Armenia. According to this ancient map, Ararat is to the northwest of Media, which was the northern portion of the Persian Empire. Of course, Ararat is where Mount Ararat was, the famous place where Noah's Ark was, somewhere up there. They've got it located better than that. I can't remember where it is exactly. Now, the next nation that's mentioned is the nation of Mene that's going to be summoned against Babylon. If you look at a map, Mene is right in the same general area as Armenia, except that it's a smaller area. It basically runs from Lake Van in the west, past Lake Urmia in the center, all the way over to the east, up to the Caspian Mountains. So, because of time differences and because of rough geographical borders, I don't think anybody can tell you exactly where the nation of Mene was as compared to the ancient nation of Ararat, but it's in the same general area of Armenia. Wikipedia says that Menea, which is sometimes written as Menea, and biblical Hebrew is Mene. Mene was an ancient kingdom located in northwestern Iran, south of Lake Urmia, around the 10th to the 7th centuries B.C. The Jewish Encyclopedia of 1906 identifies Mene with Armenia. Mene, Armenia, same general idea, same area. Now, what about Ashkenaz? That's the third kingdom that God calls to help the Persians whack Babylon with. Answers.com says that Ashkenaz is perhaps in Armenia. Wikipedia says that according to Encyclopedia Biblica, Ashkenaz must have been one of the migratory peoples which at the time of Esarhaddon. Esarhaddon was the king of Assyria who ruled from 681 to 669. These migratory peoples burst upon the northern provinces of Asia Minor and upon Armenia. One branch of this great migration appears to have reached Lake Urmia, for in the revolt which Esarhaddon chastised, the Mene who lived to the southwest of that lake sought the help of Ispakai of the land of Asgusa, a name originally perhaps Asgunza, which the skepticism of Dilman need not hinder us from identifying with Ashkenaz, and from considering as that of a horde from the north of Indo-Germanic origin, which settled on the south of Lake Urmia. Well, all that's pretty complicated. Ashkenaz sounds like the Ashkenazi Jews. I looked a little bit into that. It turns out that's a big historical problem. Where did the Ashkenazi Jews come from? Of course, they came from Eastern Europe. But before that, they were said to come from Armenia. And then somehow the idea sprung forth that they came from Germany. At any rate, all that's quite interesting for Bible geeks, but we know that we're talking about the area of Armenia. Like I said, it's just as easy to summarize it. Armenia. Let the Armenians come and help the Persians whack the Babylonians. Going back to verse 27, appoint a commander against her, against Babylon. Send up horses like a swarm of locusts. Come on, Persians, come on down and whip the Babylonians. We go now to Jeremiah 51, 28 through 32, and we will be finished with this section of scripture. Yahweh is still speaking rhetorically. Prepare the nations for battle against her, the kings of the Medes. Again, that would be Cyrus the Great and perhaps also Darius the First, Darius the Great. The kings of the Medes, their governors and all their officials and all the countries they rule. That would include Ararat and Mene, Ashkenaz. The land trembles and rise for the Lord's purposes against Babylon stand to lay waste of the land of Babylon so that no one will live there. Babylon's warriors have stopped fighting, as John Gill says, and Gill is quoting Xenophon and Herodotus, the famous Greek historians. It seems upon Cyrus's first coming, that's in 539, the king of Babylon and his army gave him battle, but being overthrown, they retired to the city and dared never fight more. Well, that would fit very well with verse 30. Babylon's warriors have stopped fighting. They remain in their strongholds. They just retreated to the city of Babylon behind the walls of Babylon, figuring the Persians aren't ever going to get in here. In fact, I think Cyrus spent over a year and a half besieging the city trying to get in. Couldn't do it until the night of Belshazzar's feast. The Babylonian strength is exhausted, Yahweh continues in verse 30. They've become like women, in other words, frightened and weak. They didn't have these he-men feminist women like we got today that can do anything and can be superheroes and can do anything and they can't have children, can't raise a family. They become like women. Her dwellings are set on fire. The bars of her gates are broken. That happened, of course, when Darius the First came in around 520, burnt the place down. Verse 31, one courier follows another, and messenger follows messenger to announce to the king of Babylon that his entire city is captured. Again, that's either Cyrus or Darius. I'm not sure which one it is, but the entire city was captured. At the time of Cyrus, John Gill, again quoting Herodotus, says this. Herodotus says that when the Babylonians, which inhabited the extreme parts of the city, were taken, they that were in the middle of it were not sensible of it because of the greatness of the city, and the rather because they were engaged that night in feasting and dancing. In other words, the couriers had to go from the suburbs of Babylon to the middle of Babylon where the feasting was going on. It says, I got bad news for you, Belshazzar. The entire city is captured. We're wiped out on the suburbs. What I'm trying to explain here in verse 31 is why does Belshazzar need messengers to announce that his city has fallen? Since he's in the city, seems like he would know it without having a messenger. But if you have to send messengers from the extremities of the city, as Herodotus says, the people in the center of the city didn't realize that the city had been taken because the extremities, the suburbs, were so far away and they were in the middle of the city getting drunk. In verse 32, the messengers are also to say that the river crossings are seized. That would be the places where people could get across the Euphrates into the riverbed to fight the Persians who are marching up the Euphrates River. The marshes were set on fire, I presume, to make it easy for the Persians to march up the Euphrates River into Babylon so they wouldn't be hindered by all the marsh grass. The soldiers are terrified. The Babylonian soldiers are terrified. Let me talk a little bit about these crossings which were seized. I'm having a little trouble picturing this, but apparently there were passages leading from the river Euphrates to the city of Babylon. Now, how to picture that, I don't know, but there were little gates at the city of Babylon. Herodotus speaks of these gates, and those gates opened up, and they would lead down to the river. Those gates were left open that night because nobody thought people would be coming up the riverbank. Those gates were left open that night because nobody thought that the Persians would be coming up the riverbed. And so apparently the Persian army took control of the entrance of a passage that would lead from the bank of the Euphrates into one of those little gates. Again, perhaps so the Babylonians would not be able to come out of those gates and attack the Persians in the riverbed. I'm speculating. I'm not an expert on that fall of Babylon, but that's what it sounds like to me. I could be wrong. We see that the soldiers, the Babylonian soldiers, are terrified in verse 32. This is what Gill says about that. The Babylonians fled and left the passes, towers, and fortresses which fell into the hands of Cyrus. As soon as they perceived his army was come up the channel and was landed, and the reeds were burnt. And we're going to leave it right there. We'll take up with the destruction of Babylon in our next audio, which I hope you will tune into. And I hope very much that you enjoyed this audio.